Oh, the Apostle by Grace by Brother John Mitchell, Chapter 29, A Risky Request. Even before he left Corinth, Paul had himself expressed foreboding regarding his forthcoming visit to Jerusalem. In his letter to the brethren in Rome, he'd asked them to pray that he might be delivered from the unbelievers in Judea, and that his service in Jerusalem might be acceptable to the saints there. Indeed, on the evening of his arrival, though none of the elders were present, the brethren of the primary ecclesia did receive him warmly and arranged for Paul and the visiting representatives of the Gentile ecclesias to see James, the Lord's brother, and the other elders formally the next day. Then, though, Luke is surprisingly silent on the matter. The presentation of the gift brought from afar took place. That was the first objective of the meeting on which Paul had entertained such high hopes. Farrar draws imaginatively on the occasion, saying, one by one, Paul would call forward the beloved delegates, that they might with their own hands lay at the foot of James the sums of money which his Gentile churches had contributed out of their deep poverty, and which in many and many a coin bore witness to weeks and weeks of self-denial. There lay all this money, a striking proof of the faithfulness with which Paul, at any rate, had carried out his share of the old compact at Jerusalem. When, almost by way of return for concessions which the Judaizers had done their best to render nugatory, the three had begged him to be mindful of the poor. It must have been a far larger bounty than they had any reason to expect, and on this occasion, if ever, we might surely have looked for a little effusive sympathy, a little expansive warmth on the part of the community which had received so tangible a proof of the Apostle's kindness. Yet we are not told about a word of thanks, and we see but too plainly that Paul's hardly disguised misgiving as to the manner in which the gift would be accepted was confirmed. One wonders whether the piles of coins, beside being evidence of the sincerity of the Gentile believers, also betokened, in Jewish eyes, the increasing ascendancy of the Gentile inheritance in the ecclesia of Christ, and something that the Jewish element found hard to accept. However it was, when the presentation was over, Paul reported in detail what he had done amongst the Gentiles through his ministry, whereupon, when the elders had heard it, they praised God. But immediately afterwards, according to Luke's narrative, they put a proposal to Paul that he must have felt unsuitable. It was that, in order to mollify the feelings of the many thousands of Jewish believers, an exaggeration surely, all of them zealous of the law, and the very people who'd waged a relentless campaign against Paul amongst Gentile believers, from Antioch in Syria to all Asia Minor and Achaia, he should engage in an extraordinary temple procedure to counter the allegation that he taught all Jews who lived amongst the Gentiles to turn away from Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or live according to Jewish customs. What should we do, they asked. They will certainly hear that you have come, so do what we tell you. There are four men with us who have made a Nazarite vow. Take these men, join in their purification rites, and pay their expenses so that they can have their heads shaved. Then everyone will know that there's no truth in these reports about you, but that you yourself are living in obedience to the law. No inkling is given in Luke's account as to who was the instigator of this suggestion, although the very fact that there were four Jews conveniently to hand who had taken the vow suggests that it had been premeditated. But what the elders were asking Paul to do was to expose his presence to special scrutiny in the temple area, where he would be vulnerable to the attentions of his bitterest enemies, who would stop at nothing to kill him. The sponsorship the Jerusalem ecclesia was asking of him was usually performed by some rich or influential person, anxious to help his poor brethren complete their vows, wherein the expenses incurred would be considerable. After engaging in the initial purification with the Nazarites, Paul would have to ensure that all the necessary sacrifices, 16 in all, and offerings were fulfilled and paid for, ending after 7 days with the ceremonial burning of the Nazarite's hair upon the altar. But who was expected to pay for all this? Incredibly, one commentator suggests the expenses may have been met from the funds Paul had brought with him. An unworthy suggestion. Surely. But up to this point, every indication had been that he had to work night and day to meet his own expenses and those of the brethren who accompanied him. And the scriptures never portrayed him as being well off. So perhaps it was left to the instigators of the scheme themselves to provide the necessary cash. But that, again, is problematical. How could an ecclesia that has just received a large amount of money for charitable purpose of helping its necessitous poor, at the same time engage in a very expensive procedure purely to gild the reputation of the missionary to the Gentiles? That indeed would have been a cause of robbing Peter to pay Paul. So the safest assumption is that Paul, in a perfectly honest and honourable way, was somehow able to tap into a source of wealth not available to him hitherto, that would stand him in good stead, not only in his present need, but also for the years to come. The idea that Paul was able to use the proceeds of some hereditary property he either could or would not use before has gained credence since it was first suggested by William Ramsay in 1895. Especially in view of his wealthier standing after the Jerusalem incident. The fact that Paul was even prepared to contemplate the course of action that the Jerusalem elders and members urge upon him, which he must have known was dangerous, shows to what lengths he was prepared to go to keep the unity of the faith, both the Jewish and the Gentile ecclesias. It meant that instead of residing quietly, perhaps with his sister who was living in Jerusalem at the time, he had, after the necessary purifications, to accompany the poor Nazarites as their sponsor to a special chamber reserved in the temple for them, from where the necessary rituals were carried out. And however carefully his identity might be shielded by the priests in charge, the risk of its being revealed was great at the time when the Pentecostal feast was being celebrated, and the temple courts were thronged with thousands of pilgrims, many of them from the diaspora. And so it happened that when the 7 days were nearly over, some Jews from the province of Asia, possibly including Alexander the coppersmith, an old enemy from Ephesus, saw Paul in the temple. They stirred up the whole crowd and seized Paul, shouting, "Men of Israel, help us! This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against our people and our law and this place. Besides, he has brought Greeks into the temple area and defiled this holy place." They had previously seen Paul in the city accompanied by a Gentile named Trophimus from Ephesus, and had assumed Paul had brought him into the court of Israel, where Gentiles were forbidden entry on pain of death. As a result of the hue and cry, the whole city was aroused, and the people came running from all directions. Seizing Paul, they dragged him from the court of Israel and down the steps into the court of the women, while the priests closed the huge Nicanor gates behind them. Lest the court of Israel should be polluted by what was about to happen, namely the slaughter of the apostle. And that, if it had not been in the providence of God, for the vigilance of Roman sentries on the ramparts of the garrison tower of Antonia that overlooked the temple, that would have been the untimely end of the apostle Paul.